Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Hi, everyone, and welcome. Today, we're diving deep into a book that, well, really changed the game for heroines in literature, Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre.
It really did. And looking through the sources, it's clear Bronte poured so much of herself and her observations into this.
Absolutely. Charlotte Bronte, living in Haworth, Yorkshire, pretty isolated life, 1816 to 1855. She really saw the constraints on women, didn't she? Especially educated women without money.
Yes. Her own experiences as a governess, they're woven right into the fabric of the novel. That intense emotional depth, that focus on a woman's inner world, it was revolutionary.
And that pseudonym, Currer Bell, quite a move.
Unnecessary one, perhaps. Uh-huh. It ensured the work was taken seriously, judged on its merits, you know, without the immediate gender bias that was so prevalent.
So Jane Eyre, 1847, it's got everything coming of age, gothic mystery, social critique.
All blended together. And the reaction back then was, well, intense. People were captivated, but also shocked. Condemned, even.
Why? Because Jane wasn't meek.
Partly, yes. Her independence, her passion, her refusal to just accept her place quietly. It ruffled a lot of feathers. Which brings us to the core question, really.
What makes this story about this seemingly plain governess still feel so radical and relevant today?
I think it's because Bronte created a heroine who demands to be seen and valued for her mind, her spirit, not just her looks or status.
Right. It's all about Jane's internal struggle, isn't it? Trying to find love, but also hold on to herself, her principles.
Exactly. Can a woman, especially one without the usual advantages, find real connection without sacrificing who she fundamentally is? That's the heart of it.
And her journey takes her through these key places, Gateshead, Lowood, Thornfield.
Morehouse, and finally Ferndene. Each place shapes her, tests her, is quite the progression.
So let's start at the beginning. Gateshead Hall. Rough start is putting it mildly.
Oh, definitely. Orphaned, unloved, living with the cruel Mrs. Reed and her awful cousins. John Reed, especially.
And that leads to the Red Room incident. It's more than just being locked in a room, isn't it?
Much more. Symbolically, it's huge. It represents that feeling of being trapped, unjustly punished. It's a kind of psychological imprisonment that echoes later.
But even then, she fights back. Verbally, anyway. That fiery spirit is there early on.
It is. That outburst against Mrs. Reed is a defining moment. It really raises that question about how early trauma shapes us, you know. For Jane, it fuels her sense of justice, her need for independence.
Which eventually leads her away from Gateshead to Lowood Institution. Escape or just a different kind of prison?
A bit of both, perhaps. Lowood is certainly harsh, grim conditions, the hypocritical Mr. Brocklehurst. It's bleak.
But not entirely hopeless. She finds connections there.
She does. Crucially, Helen Burns.
Yeah.
And Miss Temple. Helen teaches her a kind of stoicism, endurance through faith. Miss Temple offers intellectual guidance, kindness.
But Helen's death, that must have hit hard. Typhus, wasn't it?
Yes. Typhus sweeps through the school. Helen's death is pivotal for Jane. It reinforces her desire for life, for passion, but maybe tempers her rebellion with a bit of Helen's fortitude.
So after 8 years there, she's educated, disciplined, ready for what's next.
Ready for independence. Lowood, for all its flaws, gave her the tools. She doesn't just drift. She actively seeks a new life, a new position.
Which brings her to Thornfield Hall and, of course, Mr. Rochester.
Ah, Rochester. The classic Byronic hero. Dark, brooding, intelligent, cynical. Definitely carrying some baggage.
And Thornfield itself is atmospheric. Mysterious.
Very much so. There's an immediate sense of unease, secrets, that strange laughter Jean keeps hearing.
And their first meeting is hardly conventional, with his horse slipping.
No, not at all. It set the tone for their whole relationship, really. Full of sparks, intellectual challenges, witty banter. Not your typical master-governess dynamic.
He seems to test her quite a bit, doesn't he? With Blanche Ingram, for instance.
He does. He's trying to gauge her feelings, her character. Meanwhile, these strange events keep happening. The fire in his room, the attack on Mason.
All building towards the big reveal. Bertha Mason, his wife, locked away.
The gothic secret in the attic. And Bertha, she's not just a plot device. She's incredibly symbolic.
How so?
Well, many see her as representing the consequences of Rochester's past deceit, but also perhaps the repressed passion and rage of Victorian women. Even a dark reflection, a double. Of Jane's own contained intensity.
Wow. Okay, so that adds another layer entirely, which makes the proposal seem even more complex.
Deeply complex. Jane is overcome with joy, but then the wedding. the interruption.
The truth comes out right at the altar. Devastating.
No, utterly. And it exposes the rot beneath the surface of respectable society, the hypocrisy. Rochester pleads with her to stay, be his mistress.
But she won't, even though she loves him.
She can't. It violates her core principles, her self-respect. Choosing to leave is this incredibly powerful act of autonomy. Painful, but necessary for her.
So she flees, ends up completely destitute, wandering.
Until she collapses, almost dead, and is taken in by the Rivers family at Morehouse. St. John, Diana, and Mary.
A completely different world from Thornfield. And St. John Rivers. He's nothing like Rochester.
Not at all. He's a foil.
Yeah.
Cold, devout, ambitious, driven by duty, not passion. He offers Jane safety, purpose, but of a very different kind.
And then there's another twist, the inheritance.
Yes. St. John discovers Jane is related to them and has inherited a fortune from her uncle, £20,000. Suddenly, she's wealthy. Independent.
Financially independent, familially connected. Everything she lacked.
Exactly. Which makes St. John's proposal even more significant. He asks her to marry him a loveless marriage, mind you, and go to India as a missionary's wife.
A life of duty, of sacrifice. Another test for Jane.
Her final great test, really. Duty versus love, intellect versus emotion. She almost agrees she's torn.
But then something happens, that call.
The cry across the moors. Jane! Jane! She believes it's Rochester's voice reaching out to her supernaturally, telepathically.
Whether you read it as divine or psychological or just deeply symbolic.
He gives her her answer. She rejects St. John's cold duty and knows she must go back. Find out what happened to Rochester. Her heart pulls her back.
So she returns to Thornfield. Only, it's not there. Not as she knew it.
It's a ruin. Burned down. She learns about the fire, about Bertha's death jumping from the roof.
And Rochester.
He tried to save Bertha. Save the servants. He's alive, but blinded and lost a hand, living in seclusion at a place called Ferndean.
So Jane goes to him, finds him humbled, broken.
Yes. And this is crucial. His arrogance, his deceit, it's gone, burned away by his suffering. He's been redeemed, in a sense.
Which allows them to finally meet as equals.
Truly equals. Their reunion isn't about power dynamics anymore. It's about mutual need, mutual care, genuine connection. Passion and principle can finally coexist.
And that leads to maybe the most famous line.
Reader, I married him. Simple, direct, but so powerful. It's her choice, her narrative, her happy ending, achieved on her own terms.
A real triumph. Yeah. And Bronte contrasts this with St. John's fate, right? Still pursuing that rigid path.
Exactly. Reinforcing Jane's choice for a life that balances love, spirit, and selfhood.
Looking back at the whole novel, what are the big takeaways, the themes that still resonate?
Well, that core conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Passion versus principle. How do you navigate intense feelings while staying true to your moral compass? That's timeless.
And its proto-feminism feels incredibly modern still.
Absolutely. It's a powerful cry for female autonomy, for intellectual and emotional freedom. Jane demanding to be seen as a free human being with an independent will, that still gives you chills.
Plus the critique of social class, she really doesn't hold back on that.
Not at all. Jane constantly challenges the assumptions tied to wealth and status. Remember, do you think because I am poor, obscure, plain, and little, I am soulless and heartless, you think wrong? That fire is always there.
And the way Bronte tells the story, first person, all that symbolism.
It draws you right into Jane's head, her heart. The Red Room is confinement. Fire and ice is passion and repression, mirrors showing self-perception. It's also richly layered, reflecting her psychological journey.
You really feel it all with her, don't you? The injustice, the hope, the heartbreak, the final earned peace.
You absolutely do. It's a testament to resilience, to courage, and I think to the radical importance of respecting yourself enough to demand respect from others, especially in love.
It really redefines partnership as a meeting of equals.
Jane Eyre ultimately teaches us that true love blossoms from a foundation of absolute equality and unwavering self-respect, a message that continues to empower and challenge us to this day.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.